From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, this is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiburi. The focus of today's program is in vitro fertilization, known better as IVF. The process was first used in the late 1970s. At the time, a long-shot procedure. Today, it's a much more successful tool to assist in getting pregnant. And recently, IVF has been all over the news.
A decision from the Alabama Supreme Court has alarmed doctors, patients, and reproductive rights advocates.
The ruling upending IVF procedures.
The court ruled that frozen embryos created through in vitro fertilization, or IVF, are legally children and thus protected. The designation of personhood could have significant repercussions for reproductive rights.
We call on the state of Alabama to provide immediate, complete, and permanent access to IVF care for the women and families of Alabama.
Alabama lawmakers have passed a bill to immediately restore access to in vitro fertilization, and the governor quickly signed it.
Alabama's Supreme Court ruled that fertilized eggs, embryos existing outside the womb, hold the same rights as children. The decision raised many questions, halted IVF facilities in Alabama, and sparked national debate. Following the decision, Alabama state lawmakers passed legislation, approved with wide bipartisan support. It protects IVF clinics and doctors in the event of, quote, death or damage to an embryo, close quote, should it take place during the IVF process. Still, some critics say the legislation won't stand up to legal scrutiny, and there are several threads of uncertainty that linger. Here to help us better understand IVF and the situation in Alabama is Mary Scott Hodgin, health and science reporter for WBHM, based in Birmingham, Alabama. Mary Scott, welcome to Due South.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Just one quick note off the top. We're going to hear in a little while from Michelle Howard, who is an Alabama resident, and she is pregnant with her first child after undergoing the IVF process. All right, Mary Scott, a quick basic primer here right off the top. I want you to fact check it or add any important nuance, admittedly a little bit of an oversimplification, but just for our listeners, IVF is a five-step process. A woman takes fertility medication to increase ovulation. There's an outpatient procedure during which eggs are retrieved from a woman's ovaries. A sperm sample is collected. The sperm is then inseminated into the egg. Fertilization typically takes a few hours. And then finally, that embryo is transferred into the uterus. Any important clarifications that are needed?
Michelle would probably be able to, you know, provide even more clarification since she's been through that process. But that sounds, you know, right as far as I know from talking to doctors and patients who've been through it. And of course, fertilization doesn't always, it's not always successful. The embryo is not always viable. There's many, you know, parts of the process that are rife with uncertainty, but yes, that's how I understand it.
Okay. What can you tell us about the number of couples, the number of women who use IVF?
Certainly, it's becoming more and more common. I want to say like 2% is the percentage that you hear in terms of babies born thanks to IVF. And then in terms of infertility issues, I've seen, you know, during this coverage, I've seen both 1 in 6 couples, you know, will deal with infertility issue or fertility issues. I've also seen 1 in 8. I'm not sure, you know, which data point is the most accurate, but either way, it's very common.
Let's also note right up top here that IVF is expensive, often in the tens of thousands of dollars. It is not covered by healthcare. And you need to have either some real financial comfortability or a willingness to go into debt to afford IVF. Mary Scott, this major ruling came a few weeks ago. Was this even on your radar or something you were anticipating?
No, it was not on my radar. I know people were aware of this case in the fertility industry, so to speak, or, you know, the fertility healthcare space. But again, it also was not really like getting a lot of attention in that space either. It was, you know, if you want me to go into sort of the background about this case, it was from 2020, the incident that occurred where, you know, you have some couples in Mobile, Alabama, who were receiving IVF treatment at a clinic down there. And they had some embryos frozen in the freezer at this clinic. And in December of 2020, a patient at the hospital where this clinic is located, was able to wander into this freezer and actually picked up some, you know, took out some of these embryos from the freezer and then dropped them and destroyed them. And so that's what, that's where the case originated. So it's a 2020 case. Mm-hmm. It went through the court, like lower courts in the state. The parents sued the clinic and the hospital over the destruction of these embryos, and they sued under a state law called the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. And so they said, you know, you owe us damages for the death of our children, in this case, referring to the embryos that were destroyed. Lower courts dismissed the case, saying that embryos are not children, like the frozen embryos don't equate children, so it's not a, you know, you can't sue under this statute. So then they appealed to the state Supreme Court, and that's how it ended up in the state Supreme Court. And as you said, this ruling came down mid-February, kind of out of nowhere for a lot of folks.
Yeah, curiosity's got the cat here a little bit. The person who went into this clinic and destroyed the embryos, was that purposeful, and what happened to them?
So, yeah, great question. I don't know what happened to that person. We don't know. It's, you know, the court documents I've seen, this person has remained unnamed. It's listed as a patient in the hospital where this clinic was located. And the way it's written about in court documents, this incident, it's written as if it was, you know, accidental in terms of the dropping of the embryos. In terms of why this person entered the freezer and started pulling out the embryos, whether they actually knew these were embryos, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. But I have also wondered similar things.
Yeah, and I'll wonder why they were permitted to be back there, what they were doing
yes.
there. I mean, I wander all the time. My 5-year-old wanders all the time, but anyway, I'll stop.
Yeah, my understanding is the freezer was unlocked, and you know, that can be checked in court documents as well, but yeah.
So that's a little bit of the backstory of where this all originated. It gets appealed up to the Alabama Supreme Court, and mid-February, this ruling comes down. Tell us about what the ruling says, most importantly.
Yes. Okay, so the ruling says, yes, you can sue, basically, is what the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that this lawsuit can continue. That's like what the ruling says. And because they say frozen embryos are children under this Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. So this Wrongful Death of a Minor Act is from 1872. Justices say that law protects all children. They say that includes, quote, born and unborn children, and that includes, quote, extrauterine children. So they extend this protection to children that are not yet born, so children in the womb. And then they say it goes beyond that, and it is children who are outside of the uterus, because they say that embryos are mm-hmm. children. They also invoke an amendment in terms of their ruling. The ruling is saying that this act from 1872 can be applied to embryos. But they also say that's further supported by this amendment to Alabama's Constitution. This is an amendment made in 2018, so a more recent language that they're also leaning on here. And it's this Sanctity of Unborn Life Amendment, which basically says the state needs to do everything it can to protect the rights of children born and unborn, you know, unborn life.
Sure.
That amendment came in really with the intent to restrict abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so they also refer to that amendment in this ruling. The ruling, you know, if you want to talk about this as well, it also had several opinions from justices on the court. The opinion from the Chief Justice got a lot of attention because he is quotes the Bible to a lot of theologians. It's very religious in his defense
right.
for supporting the ruling.
I want to build on this premonition that embryos are people and that the, you know, they have the same rights as a child. And my mind, when I heard about the ruling and I thought about this in the short term, I thought about several different things, right? I'm a parent of two young kids, and I thought, oh, if you have, you know, a number of embryos that are in a facility, can you claim all of them as dependents from a tax purpose, right? Like, I have money that's deducted from my paycheck every month to pay for a daycare, the flexible daycare spending account. Like, could you have a flexible spending account to you know, cover the cost of embryos that are frozen? And then I'm a former political reporter. I was thinking about, if they have the same rights as children, should all of these people be considered from a census standpoint? Should we think about them as we're dealing with appropriation or a reappropriation for congressional seats? I don't expect you to have an answer to any of these things, but this is where my mind went. Where did your mind go? And are any of those rights applicable under this Alabama Supreme Court ruling?
Well, so all of those things that you just mentioned and many more, you know, have those sort of topics and questions have come up with this ruling. Like, if you say that under this law, embryos are children, then what sort of precedent does that set for all the other ways we, you know, incorporate children into laws? So those questions have come up, and it has certainly opened a lot of doors and opened that can of worms, so to speak. But in terms of what the actual ruling says, the ruling itself is pretty narrowly defining this one act, saying this one act applies to frozen embryos. And this case is a civil statute. And so it's saying, you know, you can sue for the destruction of embryos.
Many more questions, and we'll try to get a few additional answers here in just a moment. Mary Scott Hodgin, health and science reporter at public radio station WBHM in Birmingham, is on the line. In a bit, we'll chat with Michelle Howard, an IVF patient from Gulf Shores, Alabama, who is expecting her first child in September. And one quick programming note for you. Reminder, please join us here on Due South tomorrow, Friday morning, when we review the happenings from the wide world of North Carolina news and politics. We do gather each Friday with a panel of journalists to try to help synthesize just whatever is happening in the North Carolina news and political ecosystem. And hey, as a reminder, if you ever have questions or topics that you would like us to consider, please send us an email, duesouth@wunc.org. My name is Jeff Tiberi. This is Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back. This is listener-supported Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi, chatting with Mary Scott Hodgin. She is a health and science reporter based in Birmingham, Alabama, and reports for WBHM, NPR member station. We're chatting about IVF, and today we're getting into the details of a major notable decision that came from the Alabama State Supreme Court last month and dissecting some of the many impacts and questions that the ruling has triggered. Before the break, Mary Scott, we were talking about the proverbial door, you noted it, that has been opened here. We don't have a sense yet of many of the answers to many of the questions, I don't believe, but I want to rewind a little bit and have you tether, or maybe not tether, draw the line for us or not between the recent ruling in Alabama and the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade. And I want to just get a sense from you whether or not there's a clear connection between these two.
Sure. I mean, that's been a big part of this discussion. When Dobbs, the decision came down and when Roe was overturned, people were talking about this, about the impact that could potentially be had on IVF or other, you know, just the full extension of, you know, reproductive rights when you start defining life and where life begins and putting restrictions on that. In Alabama specifically, our abortion ban that the state passed actually has a carve out, or, you know, it actually specifies in utero. And so it actually did come up back then in terms of, you know, in the uterus versus out of the uterus. And there were at least mentions of IVF and not wanting the abortion ban to apply to IVF for the specific abortion ban. However, as I mentioned earlier, you have this amendment to the state constitution, the Sanctity of Unborn Life Amendment, which says that, you know, state lawmakers need to protect unborn life. And that did not have any sort of language around whether that, you know, was in utero, out of utero. And it was used in the Supreme Court ruling to say that does apply to embryos. So I feel like I've gotten a little like there's so many different
so much
like acts and stuff like that, but basically there has not been consistency in how the Alabama laws have referred to life. And so now what you've seen is there's been this huge, you know, response and outcry from folks in Alabama specifically, and of course nationwide, to this ruling, saying, you know, we support IVF, and that's kind of across political boundaries. So you see a lot of self-proclaimed Republican voters in the state really upset about the Supreme Court ruling and the impacts of it. Because I don't know if we've mentioned this, but after the Supreme Court ruling came down, you had at least three clinics in the state stop IVF treatment. And there's not very many clinics in the state anyway, so it's about half the clinics stopped offering IVF treatment. So you had a lot of people come out and say, hey, we're in support of IVF. This is not what we want. And you have state lawmakers say, oh, we don't want this either. And, you know, they did act quickly to pass this recent law. But they're also trying to wrestle with the fact that language that they've supported, you know, that has been largely anti-abortion language in the past, is now being utilized in this ruling to restrict, you know, that a ruling that has led to IVF services being limited.
Right. It's being totally repurposed. And this is it's very nebulous, right? Like, oh, we support IVF. Okay. But we need to go about four levels deeper here to get, at least from my perspective, to get a better understanding of what it is you are supporting. Let's focus, I guess, in the immediate aftermath. We're going to get to some legislation that the Alabama state legislature has since approved and has been signed into law by Republican Governor Ivey. But in the immediate aftermath, what did this mean for existing embryos, of which I assume there were hundreds, if not thousands, across the state?
Sure. In the immediate aftermath of the Supreme Court ruling?
Yes. And let me just be clear, because I've toggled between U.S. Supreme Court and Alabama Supreme Court here. So let me just recenter it to Alabama Supreme Court. After that ruling comes in mid-February, what does that mean for the embryos across the state?
Yeah, I mean, it was this huge scrambling that started happening across the, you know, across the state and across the nation, of course. But the ruling came down and it started making news, and it was kind of, you know, like, oh, what does this mean? A lot of confusion. Then you started hearing from providers. The biggest, you know, I think significant shift in terms of, oh, like the impact on providers was when the University of Alabama at Birmingham said that they were shutting down IVF services at their clinic, because the University of Alabama at Birmingham is the largest hospital in the state. And so for them to make that statement, you know, really showed, okay, this is having a big impact on IVF. So then you had two other clinics come forward and say that they were shutting down services or putting a pause on IVF services. And then it was just this general confusion, you know, like, what does this mean? Like the questions you brought up earlier in terms of, you know, if we say that a frozen embryo is a child under this law, are we going to apply it to all the other laws that we have in the state and all the other meanings that we give children in society? So in terms of actual technicalities, in addition to IVF services shutting down at three clinics, you also had embryo transport companies say, we're not going to transport embryos out of Alabama. And so then, because I had talked to patients who said, we want to move our embryos out of the state. You know, you had patients trying to figure out, what does this mean for us? And then you had patients who had embryo transfers scheduled for, you know, the next day, and then they were canceled. Or you had patients who were ready to go have their eggs retrieved. And, you know, these are healthcare decisions and actions that are in time intensive. They're very expensive, as you mentioned earlier. So these are people who've been in this process, many of them for years. And then suddenly this ruling comes down and potentially just shatters their whole plan. It's also a process that's just rife with anxiety and uncertainty. And I'm sure you'll talk about this with Michelle. You know, it's just, it's such an intense and personal experience, and it can be so painful. And so then it just added this extra layer of anxiety and uncertainty to everything.
So in this intense moment, watch out, because here come some state lawmakers who want to act quickly. In my experience, when state lawmakers act quickly, good things don't always happen. But bring us through the legislative process that follows in the wake of this. What did a large bipartisan group of Alabama state lawmakers come together to do here more recently?
Sure. Okay, so the lawmakers and the state's governor approved Senate Bill 159. This has also, sometimes folks have called it like the immunity law. So this law they approved grants civil and criminal immunity to people that are involved in the, quote, death or damage to an embryo. This law, like you mentioned, it was fast-tracked. You know, people had spoken out in strong support of IVF, and so lawmakers, you know, they came out and they said, okay, we want to do something about this. And I do want to note that you know, this ruling came down on a Friday, and it was not until the next Thursday that we really heard from lawmakers at all and heard from the state's governor at all in terms of their thoughts on the ruling and IVF and what they were going to do about it. And initially, when lawmakers came out, you know, the Republican lawmaker who ended up sponsoring this legislation, he at first said he wanted to introduce legislation to clarify that embryos are not the same as children, that embryos are something like potential life. But we never saw that bill introduced. Instead, you had lawmakers say that conversation is going to take longer. We're going to put that off because we can't get that done fast. And so instead, we saw this immunity bill come out. So yeah, so that was, you know, that was approved last week. Mm-hmm. And it was enough for two of the three clinics to resume IVF treatment. But you had one clinic come out and say, we're not going to resume treatment. This is not enough for us.
Right.
We're kind of confused in terms of the amount of protection that this provides. And that clinic that is not resuming services is the clinic that is the defendant in the case that went to the Supreme Court. So that's the clinic where you had the those embryos destroyed.
Okay, so a point of clarity and then another follow-up question here.
Sure.
To be clear, the ruling from Alabama State Supreme Court still stands. So despite any recently enacted legislation, according to the Alabama Supreme Court, fertilized eggs are children. Is that fair, or do I need to tweak that language?
I mean, that's fair. That's fair. Okay. I oftentimes will clarify, say, like, under this Wrongful Death Act.
This wrongful death suit, fertilized eggs are children or have the same rights as children. Okay. So, and I'm going to show, hopefully not put my foot in my mouth here, maybe show a little bit of ignorance, but typically when a woman has IVF, there are a number of eggs that are retrieved from the ovaries. They are, I believe, they are inseminated, they are fertilized, and then whichever one is looking the strongest, it is implanted back in the uterus. But there are other eggs. So if we're thinking about somebody who's going through this process, they're not going to put four or five or six eggs into a woman's uterus. So I'm wondering what is happening here in the short term with these other eggs. I'm assuming you're going to tell me they're going to be frozen and they're going to be preserved. So I'm going to take it one step further and go, if a woman does IVF and has five or six eggs that are fertilized, one of which is put back into her and it takes, there are several other embryos. Is it now permissible to dispose of those, or what happens to those embryos?
So based on what clinics have said, they are continuing with their IVF services, which, as you mentioned, includes, of course, freezing leftover embryos for future cycles. I mean, so, you know, you have multiple. I've talked to many families who have, you know, two children, three children, because they have had, an embryo that has been transferred and that has implanted initially after the initial IVF cycle. And then they've used one of those frozen embryos and had that one transferred and it's implanted. Now, they don't always implant. So, I've also talked to couples where they've had, you know, they may, as you mentioned, they have five eggs that are fertilized and appear to be viable, and they try transferring one, it doesn't implant. They try transferring another one, it doesn't implant. You know, and so you have to freeze them in order to have them to try again. So, yes, my understanding is the clinics are continuing with IVF services as they have in the past. Now, in terms of tweaking some of their practices, and then that question of what, okay, so a family says we're done trying, whether they've had successful pregnancies or not, they say, you know, we don't want to implant, or I'm sorry, we don't want to, that's...
We have excess embryos. What are they going to do with them?
That's right.
That's the question.
Yeah, and I think that question is a little bit still open-ended.
But if we're talking about wrongful death suits and embryos having the rights of a child, these are very dangerous questions to have unanswered, aren't they?
Right. And the legislature has not addressed that question at all. They have not, you know, put into clarification at all anything about how frozen embryos should be viewed under state law. And that's what you saw a lot of pushback, especially from Democratic lawmakers, about that aspect of this law, you know, when it was a bill and being debated. you know, they said that's kind of like the elephant in the room, right? Like, why aren't we talking about that? And but again, I do want to reiterate that the IVF community, like the fertility clinics that were vocal during this process, they really wanted this bill passed because they wanted to get back to patient care.
Sure, they want to get back to business, and I understand that. I fully understand that, and I do think that it's probably a step forward to have this clarification, this new law. But it also, as you are pointing out here, just enhances. And I don't mean to be flip about all this, the messiness of all this. This is really a mess. Let me just drop in here really quick, Mary Scott, before we go too far afield from it. You spoke with a Democratic House representative about SB 159. This is the legislation that the Alabama legislature approved recently. You spoke with Representative Chris England, who offered his thoughts on why the bill presents more problems than solutions.
100% support IVF treatment, and it's unfortunate what has happened. But this is a really bad piece of legislation. Across the board, and let me tell you why. I'm a lawyer by trade. You cannot specifically create immunity to address enough of the issues that lawyers are paid to spot in terms of filing lawsuits. And what we're doing right now is just trying to play lawsuit whack-a-mole. We aren't providing a solution here. We're creating more problems. We have to confront the elephant in the room.
That's Chris England, Democratic House Representative, state lawmaker in Alabama, who spoke with Mary Scott Hodgkin, health and science reporter at WBHM public radio station in Birmingham, Alabama, who is now with us on the line on Due South, chatting about the IVF mess is the word I used earlier. And I don't mean to sound flip about it. Mary Scott, I want to be respectful and mindful of your time. So we'll wrap up our conversation in a moment. But I am interested in what Representative England, who is a Democrat and is in the minority in Alabama state legislature, and or other Republicans, what are state lawmakers wanting to do next in the short term, if anything, on this issue?
Well, you had lawmakers across the board say that you're going to have this conversation in the future. Like, this is an ongoing conversation in terms of needing to clarify or define embryos and frozen embryos. And then you obviously have differences in terms of what Democratic lawmakers and Republican lawmakers are focusing on. Democratic lawmakers from the beginning, they introduced a separate bill that did clarify and, you know, separate and define and say, you know, frozen embryos are not children. But that bill has not been brought up for a vote. It's, you know, it was introduced and it has not moved really since that. And then on the Republican side, you have some Republican lawmakers who have during this process been vocally opposing this immunity bill, but for reasons where they think that IVF needs to be more regulated. And they think that, you know, passing this law is in fact harming embryos because they do take on, I guess, more of a viewpoint that frozen embryos are children and that, you know, they need to be protected in that way. So you have also this discussion about regulating IVF moving forward. You have lawmakers referring to laws out of Louisiana where they have regulated IVF and you know, what can be done with leftover embryos. And so that's a question in terms of, will we see that in the future? Will Alabama put restrictions on IVF regarding what can be done with leftover embryos? Will the state, you know, put in a definition about how we view embryos? And the other question that has brought up, which Representative Chris England has been vocal about, is that since we have a constitutional amendment from 2018, the Sanctity of Life Amendment, will we need to add another amendment to the Constitution to, you know, clarify, so to speak, that embryos are or are not included in that definition? So certainly a lot of questions have been brought up by this, and we'll have to see what happens.
You've been very generous with your time. I lied. I have one more for you, Mary Scott. Lawsuits are rarely existing in a vacuum. Are you aware of any other similar types of legal challenges in other states?
Oh, I don't know. I will say that there have been lawsuits in other states about the destruction of embryos and, you know, seeking damages for that. Now, I don't think, you know, because this is under state statute, right? So every state's going to have different statutes. I'm not sure if in other states you've seen folks try to make similar claims under like a Wrongful Death of a Child Act. But I do know that there are other lawsuits that have gone through and cases that have sort of set different precedents regarding how embryos are viewed when it comes to civil suits. So, you know, are they viewed as property? So I think that is my understanding, that in other cases they've been viewed as property loss. So I know that we've seen that in other states. I will say here in Alabama, we already have another lawsuit filed under the Wrongful Death of a Minor Act out of that same, because, you know, related to that same incident down in Mobile. So it's a, you know, different couple who's filed a suit, perhaps more than one couple, but another lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of different plaintiffs is under the same statute, and it was filed, you know, before this law was passed. And so that'll be interesting to also watch and see what happens, because based on how the law was written, it's my understanding that it does not protect lawsuits that are already in the works. You know, it protects moving forward, and it's retroactive, but it doesn't protect ongoing litigation.
Mary Scott Hodgen, health and science reporter at public radio station WBHM, based in Birmingham, Alabama. Mary Scott, thank you for joining us on Due South.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Due South on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Welcome back. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We're talking IVF, the Alabama Supreme Court ruling, and we turn our attention now to Michelle Howard. She's with us on the line from Gulf Shores, Alabama. She's an IVF patient, and she is pregnant, expecting her first little one, a little boy, in September. Michelle Howard, welcome to Due South.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here, and I'm going to say right off the top, as I just said to you before we started recording, we're going to get a little personal. And if I get too personal at any point, you please tell me, hold the line if you need to. How long have you been doing the IVF process, and how much money have you spent doing this?
We've been doing actual IVF since August 2021, and we have spent right at about $80,000 to $90,000.
$80,000 to $90,000. And
yeah,
I said I'd get personal, and here we go. I don't have $80,000 or $90,000 lying around. did you lean on family or friends? Did you take out a loan? How have you financed that, or do you have some great health coverage that covers this?
I actually was a teacher for 7.5 years at a high school, and I coached softball. And so we definitely did not have that insurance coverage. Some people do get lucky with that. We did not get lucky with that. But at my clinic, we have packages that you can purchase to kind of make it not as expensive.
Okay.
So I did the larger package just in case. And so that was $38,000. And then all of the medication that you have to get, shots, stem medications, estrogen patches, progesterone, anything extra that you have to have is all separate. And for each egg retrieval, it's about $7,000 to $9,000. Wow. And we did 3 egg retrievals, and then each transfer. So it all added up to be about $80,000 to $90,000. And we actually did a home equity line of credit on our house.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were able to get the loan in summer of 2021. It took quite some time, but we did get it right before the IVF run in August. And so luckily my nurse was able to get me on the schedule for August 21st run. And mm-hmm. we were able to do it then, which actually we're about to finally sell our house and the baby loan goes away.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Both on the pregnancy and on the baby loan going away.
Thank you.
Earlier in the hour with Mary Scott, we talked about the steps of IVF, admittedly an oversimplified view of it. But the very first step, I think a lot of our listeners know this, but I think a lot of our listeners might be unfamiliar with it. The very first step is a woman who's wanting to get pregnant taking fertility medication to increase ovulation. And I know from some of my personal friends, their experience, this has involved, for some of them, getting shots. And it has involved their partner, just quite bluntly, giving them the shot in the butt. To the extent you'd like to pull the curtain back on that a little bit, tell us, what was that like for you?
Right. So we actually started out at the very, very beginning, which is called IUI, which is where they, artificial insemination, they just take your husband's sample and they just, insert it via catheter into your uterus and hope that, you know, you fertilize. That we did that 4 times and we ended up blowing $4,000 because it didn't work, but our doctor prepared us for it to not work. So that's where we started. And then we moved on to IVF, which I was extremely nervous about starting that because of the shots and because of the process of the medication and the hormones and how it can make your body feel. And I don't know if you're going to touch on mental health with IVF, but it is definitely a thing. But the shots at first scared me. And my husband tried to give them to me in my stomach, which is where you're supposed to give the stimulation shots for your egg retrievals. He tried to give them to me, but I can handle more pain if I give it to myself. So I did all of those myself, and I ended up just, it was fine. It was okay. I was really nervous at first, but I ended up being okay. And then when you do a transfer, you're about to put an embryo back in, you'll do progesterone and oil shots in your upper butt cheek. And my husband obviously had to give those to me. And I was not a fan of those. I would wake up in the mornings dreading those every day because we would do it in the evening. And I would just, you know, stroll on over to the kitchen. He would draw it up and I'd be like, here we go. Like, it was just like this dreaded process every day because the needles are a lot longer and thicker because it's in oil. So it has to be able to go through the needle.
Got it. Michelle Howard is with us here on Due South. She is an IVF patient. She is pregnant and she is expecting a little boy later this year. And she's telling us about her story as it pertains to IVF. $80,000 to $90,000, multiple egg retrievals, shots in the upper butt cheek. This doesn't sound particularly pleasant. Obviously, the light at the end of the tunnel, the goal, the dream, the desire to raise a child that you and your partner have created, I get that. I have two little ones. Did you think about giving up at any point, or did you think about, well, this might not be for us?
If I'm being completely honest with you, no. I never once thought about giving up. In fact, we were on our last retrieval. You only got 3 full cycles of IVF, which is 3 full retrievals. And we never got really any embryos. Out of 3 retrievals, we got 4 total embryos. And we've 5 total embryos, correction. And 3 of them didn't work. 2 miscarriages. 1 just did not stick. And we have 1 in the freezer right now. So no, I never thought about giving up. And I actually would ask my nurses, like, do you think it's crazy if I were to spend thousands of more dollars to do this again? And I never had anyone say, yes, you're crazy for not trying or for still going.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it almost just becomes like this addiction to, like, if you know, like, people get addicted to gambling because they're like, oh, just one more try.
Interesting.
And I just kept telling my husband, like, no, I want to try just one more time because it literally only takes 1 time. And I was like, no, we're going to keep trying. But last August, when our retrieval went very south, we thought about adoption. My husband and I did think about, like, okay, maybe this is the end of the road for us. And we were like, maybe we should just adopt. And then we got a phone call that 2 of our embryos were perfect little babies and we could transfer them. And that completely turned my life around.
You said something earlier, and I want to follow up on it before I forget. You said mental health and the IVF process. And my mind went to, like, oh, postpartum and postpartum depression. But I have a hunch that that's not what you're talking about. Talk to me, pull on that thread a little bit, if you would. Mental health and how yours has been, I imagine, challenged during this 3-year ordeal.
So basically, the the continued use of hormones and pumping those into your body repeatedly, that can just make your life very much a roller coaster mentally, physically. Before I started IVF, I was very fit and very lean and very into fitness and working out. And now I'm 50 pounds heavier than I was when I started IVF. And it's because of the medication and not being able to be super active anymore. You start as a female asking yourself, does your husband still want to be with you? Are you able to, I can't provide a child for my husband. Like, what does he think about this? Because I know that a lot of husbands aren't just going to come out and say, well, this just isn't going to work out, you know? So I was wearing that for quite some time. And I finally just let it out to my husband, actually, last April when we had our last miscarriage. And I was like very paranoid. I was having dreams about it. Post miscarriage, or right when having an IVF miscarriage, I don't really know if it's the same for people who conceive naturally, but it wore on me really bad. Like, my nurses were calling to check on me. I'm walking around the neighborhood one day crying. Like, I couldn't control my body and like how I felt and stuff. So I was really going through a rough time because I didn't know how to kind of handle myself. And on top of that, I can't give my husband a child. My body is 50 pounds heavier. Mm. I'm just kind of going through this mental health, just roller coaster of, okay, one day I'm super happy. The next day I literally am so upset and almost depressed. And then the next day I'm really happy because, oh, your embryos might be doing good. Or the next day, oh, they're doing bad. So it really is constant anxiety and just like sadness.
Thank you for sharing that. That sounds awful. Just stating the obvious out loud here. I want to pivot to the ruling that came from the Alabama State Supreme Court a few weeks ago. You are 14 weeks pregnant as we are having our conversation. This ruling arrived as you were in the first term of your pregnancy. I remember watching my wife during the period, the first trimester when she was pregnant with our two children, nauseous and tired, and just adjusting to like the reality of this tiny little thing growing inside of you. I'm setting that as the backdrop. What was your reaction and what did you make of this ruling when you found out about it?
If I'm being completely honest, when I first heard about it, I kind of thought to myself, like, this isn't, like, why are we even giving this attention? Kind of like, I was just kind of thinking to myself, like, there's no way this will stand. There's no way this is going to last. Like, these are just people kind of making an impulse decision and it's going to blow over. And then days and days and days passed. And then the Chief Justice made the final decision that embryos were declared children outside of the womb. And I was like, oh, wait, they're for real about this. Like, this is actually happening. Yeah. My IVF clinic is closing. They didn't close, but they did. They had to stop
IVF halted treatments. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And so I was like, this is a lot more serious than I thought. And then I created a Facebook group called Protect IVF. And I was talking to a bunch of women. It gained like 300 group members in 6 days. And we were just all kind of coming together, like, what can we do as a group of Alabama women to kind of let these legislators know that this drastically affects us as families? Like, I got very, very lucky that I'm pregnant before all this happened. But we do have another embryo in the freezer that we've 100% plan to transfer. And I can't imagine what these women that were about to have an egg retrieval or about to do a transfer feel like getting a call from the clinic saying that they have to put their treatment on hold because of a Supreme Court ruling. I could not. I have a couple of friends who their cycles got canceled, and all I wanted to do was cry for them because I couldn't imagine.
And just to underscore this, it's not like you have a tooth that needs a filling, or you got some loose cartilage in your knee and you're going to go in for a scope or something like that. Like, this is a longer process. We talked about the shots. This is, you know, A to Z. This can take years for some people. Yes. So for it to just abruptly stop it's not how it's designed to go, and it's not how it typically goes. So you talk about, you know, some of the mental anguish earlier. That's got to be kind of a huge factor there. So you start this Facebook group. You have been very outward on social media. You have a sizable TikTok presence and following as you're sharing your journey and your story. Why? And what are you hoping to accomplish in light of the recent ruling with your presence on social media?
I started this whole thing on Instagram, and I told my husband, I'm going to start from the very bottom and from the time that we start our treatment and go all the way until he's older. Like, I want him to see everything that we didn't know he was a him at the time, but I want our son or daughter to see what we did and the support that they have gotten through all of this. We have an army following us, and the amount of support that I have gotten makes me emotional because it's just, I don't feel like I deserve that. And I don't know how I got so lucky to have these people that have just been so supportive of us through this entire journey, but it overflowed into my TikTok, and I just kind of made it into an infertility TikTok, recording my journey, posting it, all this stuff. And people love to watch that stuff. But then also, you're getting moms that are going through IVF. You're getting these families that are going through IVF and infertility and all this stuff that are looking for support, and they're looking for someone that they can relate to.
Michelle Howard is with us on Due South. We unfortunately have just another minute or two. I do want to note that the clinic that did your IVF treatment, CRM for short, Center for Reproductive Medicine, is the defendant in the case that we've been talking about, the case in which the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled last month. And they are still not back up and running, if I've got my intel correct, doing IVF treatments. I do want to ask you, I guess it sounds like you have one other embryo that is being stored and you do hope to use it someday.
Yes.
I guess, what does it cost to store a frozen embryo, if you have even a sense of that? And if a woman has 5 or 6 eggs retrieved and ends up using 2 fertilized eggs, embryos, but still has 4 more, what would it cost to just store them in perpetuity, because you might have to do that?
Right. It's $50 per month per embryo. So I'm $50 a month right now, but if I had more, it would be $50 per embryo, which that could lead me into something a lot better about the Supreme Court situation. So just if you want to hear that part.
Go ahead. Yeah, give it to me quick if you would. I have no idea where you're going.
Okay, so the Supreme Court decision with the storage of the embryos, that leads into a whole nother monetary situation, because if they were to state that embryos are children, which they did already, but if it stood, let's say that I had 5 embryos that I had make it, and let's say I PGT tested them, genetically tested them, and only 3 of them came back normal, the other 2 are abnormal, cannot be transferred. That means it could cause health issues to the child, to the mom, a lot of harm. We now would have to pay $50 a month for both of those embryos, so $100 a month, to store abnormal embryos for the rest of my life, because they won't let us discard them.
I don't know if that's the best or the worst or the most appropriate place to conclude, but I think that's where we're going to.
No,
we got one more. I want to end on a happy note. Earlier this week, you had a visit, and if I'm reading your TikTok correctly, you got to hear something for the very first time. Tell us what you heard and tell us how special that moment was.
Are you talking about his heartbeat? It makes me insanely just giddy, and I could cry right here for everyone to hear, but it's the first time that I've gotten it on the Doppler at home, and that is amazing. I just am so, the people at CRM, I am indebted to them for the rest of my life, because if without them and without the IVF care and without the technology and my nurses and my team of doctors, there is no way that I would be able to have this child. And I am just like beyond myself.
A huge and sincere congratulations. Michelle Howard, IVF patient, is expecting her first child, a little boy, who is due in September. She joined us on the line from Gulf Shores, Alabama. Michelle, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm Jeff Tiberi. You've been listening to Due South on WUNC.